Welcome back once again to Principles of Environmental Toxicology. And here we are at the fourth lecture on environmental cases, case studies dealing with various types and classifications of environmental chemicals in the environment. Today's lecture, what we'll do is finish up with three extraordinarily interesting, from a personal basis, these case studies. The personal basis is that all three of these I have intimate, either personal or familial contact with these sites. The first site that we're going to talk about, the Rocky Mountain Arsenal, my brother-in-law is actually one of the on-site managers of the cleanup. The Chemdyne site in Hamilton, Ohio is actually the place where I went to high school, and some of the activities, not all of them, happened while I was living in Hamilton, Ohio, and I know many community members that were personally affected by this particular local tragedy. And then finally, we'll talk about a very interesting case study dealing with how the U.S. military is decommissioning and realigning some of the bases that they have, not only here, but around the world. Our learning objectives to follow up on this is that we are going to explore the environmental challenges of the Rocky Mountain Arsenal. This is the RMA. It's in Colorado. They did some chemical warfare, munitions, and pesticides development there back in the 40s and the 50s, up and through the 70s, and in a certain sense, recommissioning or decommissioning this site, a very complex contaminated site, and that is close to downtown Denver, Colorado, recommissioning this as a national wildlife refuge. The next case study, we'll try to look at the environmental effects, some of the chemical fate and transport and receptors, and we'll take a very engineering, especially subsurface hydrology engineering approach to the Chemdyne site in Hamilton, Ohio. Chemdyne was a waste recycling facility for chemical waste, industrial byproducts. This is a worst case scenario if a facility like this happens. It was mismanaged and in fact impacted a large sector. This cleanup, even though it happened decades ago or started decades ago, is still underway, and we'll talk about the complexity of subsurface transport in reviewing this case study. Finally, we'll do a short vignette on environmental cleanup and a transition of Midway Island from a naval air station. This is World War II naval air station, and again to a bird sanctuary for over 2 million nesting birds. This one's quite interesting in that this is your classic El Napal site, light aqueous phase liquids, and so primarily, as you can imagine, for a refueling station, a little island almost in the middle of nowhere, it actually was the gas station for many of the planes and ships in the Pacific Theater during World War II. With that, it had a tremendous potential for leakage into the local island environment. We'll review that leakage and how they actually went about cleaning it up, about 8 to 10 years ago. Well, to start off, let's talk about the Rocky Mountain Arsenal, the RMA, and this is in Colorado. It's located approximately 10 miles northeast of downtown Denver, Colorado. It's interesting because as you stand on the site, you can look off on the prairie horizon, and just above the heads of the prairie dogs, you see the skyscrapers of downtown Denver. What's also interesting is from a development point of view, this part of the country has undergone tremendous development along the Front Range mountains there, and this is a unique open area. And in fact, what we're going to do is talk about how they are now transitioning this into a national wildlife refuge, as well as doing on-site management of many of the contaminants from its decades worth of industrial and military chemical manufacturing. Its history goes back to 1942 at the height of World War II when the U.S. Army purchased about 17,000 acres of land. So it's a very large tract of land. They used it to manufacture chemical weapons, one of the approaches to military strategy in World War I and World War II. The chemicals manufactured there included the mustard gas, which is a vesicant or a blistering agent, some nerve gases, white phosphorus. White phosphorus is used in incendiary devices and also in tracer bullets. When you see that nighttime footage of troops firing bullets that apparently glow in the dark, these are phosphorus-coated bullets. And as well as napalm, essentially a a mixture of gasoline or a fuel and a jelly to essentially have a flammable impact in terms of combustion. Now this map gives you a little bit of geography. Colorado is a nice square state, Denver about in the middle, and just as we drop away from Denver is the Rocky Mountain Arsenal. It's kind of a longish box as signified by this particular box in this particular map. Its closeness to the downtown metropolitan area is perhaps of greatest interest in terms of receptors. Well, between 1942 and the end of World War II in 1945, the arsenal made about 155,000 tons of chlorine, mustard gas, and arsenic trioxide, as well as about 87,000 tons of various chemical products. Private industry at the end of the war was encouraged to lease facilities on this site because, in fact, many of the nerve gas products that are used, sarin gas, for example, is an organophosphate compound. And we've talked about organophosphate compounds in the context of neurotoxicity and in the context of cholinesterase inhibition. So in fact, what happened was some chemical companies that did agricultural pesticides, agricultural insecticides, saw the manufacturing facilities at RMA as being advantageous to their marketplace as well. What happened was Julius Hyman and Company, JHC, began producing pesticides in 1946. In 1952, the Shell Chemical Company acquired this JHC company, and they continued to manufacture pesticides on this particular site until 1982. So this is relatively recent history. Whenever we use agricultural chemicals, whether it's fly spray in the house or ant spray or something in the gardens, or in fact when it is used in commercial agriculture, those chemicals have to come from somewhere. There has to be a manufacturing facility somewhere. This for Shell Chemical and their pesticide division was one of their manufacturing sites. Shell Chemical made various pesticides, insecticides, and herbicides at the arsenal until about 1982. In the meantime, the Army actually continued producing nerve agent at the site, and this is the Cold War buildup, and this was from 1953 to 1957. This archival photograph from the Department of the Army shows one-ton canisters of CB gas, chemical biological warfare gas, on a loading platform. The Army and various private chemical manufacturers disposed of all the liquid wastes associated with their manufacturing operations in an open basin, a number of open basins, and it was not common practice at this point in time to worry about groundwater, and so these were unlined ditches. They allowed, because they were unlined, and this was somewhat high desert prairie sandy soils, there was potential for leakage. That leakage was first observed in 1955 by nearby residents that noticed crop damage and then voiced concern about some of the contaminated water, some of the smells coming out of the water that they were pumping out of their wells. As a result of all of this, a line basin, historically called Basin F, and in fact, I had the opportunity about 3 weeks ago to meet an ex-military fellow that later went on to serve in Washington, D.C. in various administrative military capacities, who actually was one of the Department of Defense oversight members that actually did develop Basin F. Basin F was one of the first lined basins in terms of hazardous waste management in the United States. This is a somewhat forward-looking technology in 1956 when we really didn't understand what was going on with groundwater, groundwater hydrology, and what was happening beneath our feet. This basin liner, however, failed pretty immediately. It really was not well constructed. It was constructed out of asphalt, and it was just an improperly prepared. So although the idea of lining the basin was a good one, the engineering was not really well developed. And to be honest, they implemented probably the best available strategy they had at that time. This 93-acre asphalt-lined pond was capable of holding 243 million gallons of contaminated liquid. Again, remembering what they are manufacturing there, nerve agents, blistering agents, pesticides, insecticides. So the contamination potential, the lethality, and the toxicity of some of the liquids and the byproducts of this particular waste stream was fairly significant. Well, the Army and Shell began a systematic investigation into the contaminations of this in the follow-up of the creation of the EPA and a lot more environmental concern in the 1970s. Beginning in 1974, there was a sufficient amount of new regulatory science and regulatory approaches to managing this, including the Army Installation Restoration Program. In 1974, there were some what were referred to as interim response actions, or IRAs. There was quite a few of these, about 14 total. These were cleanup and construction demolition activities to start managing the contamination on site, including the groundwater contamination. From that time to recent history, over 1 billion gallons of groundwater were pumped up and treated each year. This is a fairly significant engineering accomplishment, just not only for the size, but for the lethality of the toxic agents. Now remember, all of this activity on this particular site was going on literally only a few miles away from downtown Denver, from the surrounding communities, and so there was a tremendous amount of community interaction at the local, at the state, and also cooperatively at the federal and military levels. And so there had to be a lot of discussions around a table on what was the best way to deal with this high level of highly toxic contamination. Some of the groundwater contaminants that were observed, DIMP, diisopropyl methyl phosphonate, this was one of the byproducts of nerve gas formation. You can see the phosphate group from the organophosphorus. There were pesticides, solvents, arsenic, fluoride, and various other chemicals, including chloride from chlorine manufacture. Most of the health risks on the site can be tied to four chemicals, and so this is when we do the COPEX, constituents of potential concern, and then we go to the next level in terms of how much is there and how available are the chemicals that are there, and what is the hazard quotient associated with those chemicals. When we did that reduction, we found that aldrin-dieldrin, two organochlorine insecticides, dibromochloropropane, DBCP, an herbicide, and arsenic were the primary chemicals of risk-mediated concern. Now these COPEX that also appeared on site are things like semivolatile organic compounds like chloroacetic acid, dicyclopentadiene, hexachlorocyclopentadiene as well. Some VOCs are volatile organic compounds, and these often are quite simply classified as solvents, but things like benzene and carbon tet, chloroform chlorobenzene, dibromochloropropane, DBCP, dichloroethane, and the list goes on. A lot of chlorinated solvents used in manufacture, but also in synthesis of many of these chemicals. Some of the metals on site, arsenic, because of the arsenic trioxide, chemical warfare agent, cadmium, chromium, lead, and mercury. And so we're starting to see that we have a mixed waste problem, mixed waste from the point of view of inorganics and organics. Some apparent compound pesticides, as well as their metabolites, aldrin, chlordane, DDE, DDT, dieldrin, endrin, and isodrin. This right here is more than half of the list of the dirty dozen pesticides. These are the historical persistent bioaccumulative and toxic agricultural chemicals that literally starting in the 70s, and if you look at Rachel Carson's readings, probably even in the late 50s, were recognized as problem chemicals that need to be dealt with in a very, very significant fashion to mitigate any potential toxicosis associated with their use. And in fact, it is probably best if they are not used in agriculture. Well, following this, there was a pollution control and cleanup agenda. Currently, there are no chemicals or chemical weapons produced or stored at the RMA, and this pretty much, again, stopped in the 1980s. There have been high-level contamination of various environmental media. The buildings that manufactured, this is the nerve gas plant at the Rocky Mountain Arsenal. There are some remnants that exist throughout the site. In 2001, it was on the national news that one of the cleanup crews that was excavating on site uncovered five sarin bomblets about the size of grapefruits containing active nerve gas. These were not documented. They essentially just were buried somewhere, subsurface shallow, and they uncovered them with heavy equipment. This creates a great deal of community concern, as you can imagine, that there is essentially a discovery of active sarin bomblets only a few miles away from residential areas. In terms of the remediation approach to the Rocky Mountain Arsenal, one of the biggest and most highly engineered solutions to the problems, especially the liquid waste that had been impounded in some of the basins on site, as well as the pump and treat facilities, was the development of the SQI, or the submerged quenched incinerator. This was a very impressive engineering development, the idea that you could incinerate the organics being pulled off of this pumped water from a pump and treat operation, but that you quench even the fumes from the incineration process through another water channel to strip out even some reactive byproducts. The idea here is that even the combustion byproducts, and even when we have what is referred to as destruction removal efficiency, DREs greater than 6.9s, and that's 99.9999% destruction, that even when we have that, we have significant amount of potential trace contaminant still in the incineration plume. And so the idea was we not only will do the primary incineration, but that we will quench the gaseous contaminants coming off of the incineration through water to strip it out to make it even cleaner because of the toxicity of some of these compounds. This, I am sure, was a product of negotiation with some of the surrounding community members, because remember that there are very nervous citizens living downwind of this facility wondering whether or not they are going to be gassed by some of the products that are being managed on this site. It did actually treat some of the more contaminated wastes, 11 million wastes on site, about 11 million gallons of the Basin F liquids and decontamination water. Because it had served its purpose, it was actually demolished when all related activities were completed with Basin F in May 1996. There was a tremendous amount of construction. This was an active military base, military operation, military manufacturing, and so many of the facilities which date to the 1940s had to be demolished just because of the contamination in the structures themselves. This one is Building 4112. This was the mustard gas, mustard agent manufacturing facility. It was also demolished in 1995. What you can imagine is that all of the people working on the site have tremendous levels of PPE, or personal protection gear, on to prevent contamination. In fact, one of the biggest challenges in actually decommissioning this site was the fact that, especially on hot summer days, the individuals working in some of these contaminated areas, for all intents and purposes, had to have full air, essentially scuba suits, which when an individual is laboring under the hot Colorado sun in summertime, you've got probably 15 to 30 minutes maximum of actual work time before you have to disrobe and go take a break because of the heat and the discomfort associated with these. And this has to do with managing these highly toxic compounds. Now, what did happen in terms of managing the on-site waste? The idea was, well, we can't really take some of these contaminated materials anywhere else in terms of managing them any further. And so let's develop an on-site landfill, but to modern standards, engineered for 100 plus years of geochemical and geostability. And so what they did is they developed a triple line on-site capped landfill. And this will be, this is the repository for much of the RMA waste, some of the building structure materials that can't be cleaned, things like wood, where the chemicals have impregnated the wood, whereas, for example, some of the metals that they, and steel structures, they can actually clean those for recycling. Now, what's important to consider here is that during all of this, there was some involvement by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. This began in 1986, especially after a communal roost of bald eagles, which is then an endangered species, was discovered on site. This down here gives an idea of a historical photograph from the 1950s of the Colorado Prairie, what it looked like before RMA really grew and developed into the massive manufacturing complex it became. Because there was quite a bit of open space, and the open space had to do with buffering what was recognized even from the beginning as a very toxic site and toxic operations, they found that this had become a little bit of a reservoir community for all of the development that surrounded Denver, including the new Denver Stapleton Airport. So it was soon discovered by biological analyses that there were about 300 wildlife species associated with that, including deer, coyotes, and owls. And so there's fairly abundant resources on this highly contaminated site. So in 1992, the Rocky Mountain Arsenal National Wildlife Refuge Act actually designated the arsenal to become a national wildlife refuge once cleanup is completed. And so now you've got the biology, fish and wildlife managers working hand in hand in terms of detoxifying and creating habitat of what was once a highly contaminated environment. Think of this also in terms of our risk assessment, risk management discussions, in that there are primary concerns about land use involved in risk management. And this is probably not an area, even if you clean up most of the materials, this is probably not an area that you want to have residentials, communities develop, schools, parks, and kids. However, having the ability to return this to, for lack of a better term, contaminated prairie or lightly contaminated prairie, but a place where perhaps in landfills under the surface there might be some particularly hazardous materials, that returning the surface to its prairie ecology is probably an appropriate mechanism, appropriate management for this particular site. What we're going to do here is show a quick video for you that will explain this from the point of view of the people that are managing the Rocky Mountain Arsenal. It'll go in detail some of the cleanups, some of the challenges in terms of the diversity and dispersion of the chemicals on site, and as well give you some historical footage to identify what happened, when, and why, in a certain sense, our generation is being tasked with the management of this particular risk site.
Each new day brings with it another sign that the Rocky Mountain Arsenal continues its journey into becoming one of the premier urban wildlife refuges in the country. The Arsenal is a 27 square mile facility located just 10 miles northeast of downtown Denver. This rolling prairie was settled by farmers who worked the soil for generations until the U.S. government purchased the land so the Army could produce chemical weapons during World War II. Following the war, various companies leased arsenal facilities, including Shell Chemical Company, which produced pesticides. Although widely accepted waste disposal practices were used over the years that the RMA produced weapons and pesticides, contamination did occur in some areas. Soil and groundwater beneath the arsenal became contaminated by the burying of waste, the use of open basins for evaporation of hazardous liquid, wind dispersion, sewer line leaks, and accidental spills. Today, there are no chemicals or weapons produced or stored at the arsenal, and the cleanup of contamination is underway. The Army is leading the restoration effort with assistance from Shell Oil Company, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and participation from the Environmental Protection Agency, the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment, and the Tri-County Health Department. The final cleanup plan is outlined in the Record of Decision, or ROD, signed in 1996, and is being expedited by the Remediation Venture Office, or RVO, made up of the Army, Shell, and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Throughout its history, the arsenal has always served as a home for a variety of wildlife. This combination of prairie, shrubland, woodlands, and wetlands supports nearly 300 different species of animals. Congress has directed the Fish and Wildlife Service to manage the arsenal as if it were a national wildlife refuge. So as the environmental cleanup is taking place, the service is managing education programs, public uses, and the site's abundant wildlife. Once cleanup is complete, the arsenal will officially become part of the National Wildlife Refuge System. During remediation, the Fish and Wildlife Service monitors wildlife on site. Monitoring the wildlife helps the service determine possible effects of contamination and impacts remediation activities have on the fish and wildlife populations. Samples taken at the arsenal indicate that contaminants have affected some wildlife, mainly in the manufacturing areas located in the center of the site. However, wildlife generally are healthy, and their conditions are expected to improve as cleanup continues. The Army and Shell carefully examined the contaminated sites at the arsenal. More than 50,000 samples were taken from the ground and surface water, air, soil, and structures. The findings are summarized in some 230 reports. The contaminants of greatest concern include chemical munition byproducts, pesticides, heavy metals, and solvents. More than 320 locations of suspected contamination were examined, and of those, 178 sites containing measurable levels of contamination were identified. Most of those contaminated sites are in the central sections of the arsenal, in and around manufacturing complexes, solid and liquid waste disposal areas, basins, and sewer lines. Some of the cleanup, which began as early as 1979 at the arsenal, is complete. Interim response actions, or IRAs, were used to contain or eliminate contamination problems, while final cleanup solutions were determined. Examples of IRAs include the excavation of the Basin F disposal pond and the destruction of its liquid waste by the submerged Quench incinerator. In a two-year period, the incinerator safely destroyed more than 11 million gallons of hazardous liquid. Once the IRA was complete, the incinerator was dismantled and removed from the arsenal in 1995. The 14 completed interim response actions include the closure of the hydrazine rocket fuel blending facility, dust control, asbestos removal, wastewater treatment, covering and revegetation of disposal areas, and the removal of chemical and weapons manufacturing equipment. Some structures, such as cleaned metal storage tanks and piping, were shipped off-site and recycled. One of the first IRAs, the Boundary Groundwater Treatment Facilities, cleans contaminated groundwater before it is put back into the aquifer. Nearly 1 billion gallons of water are treated each year. These systems will continue to be an integral part of treating contamination at the arsenal well into the future to assure that polluted groundwater will not leave the arsenal. There are not any significant levels of air contamination. In fact, Rocky Mountain Arsenal air quality is superior to that of nearby urban areas when compared to air pollution standards. Air quality monitoring and odor monitoring will continue throughout all phases of cleanup activities to ensure continued safety of workers, visitors, and nearby communities. As mentioned earlier, the final cleanup plan for the arsenal is outlined in the ROD. It took years of study, litigation, and public meetings with interested residents in the surrounding communities to reach the agreement on a cleanup program. The agreement requires that all cleanup actions meet or exceed state and federal health and safety standards. Public involvement ensured, among other things, there will be no incineration of soil, dust and odor issues will be controlled through each remediation project, and that new water would be supplied to residents whose wells were affected by the contamination. The public is also an integral part of the advisory organizations assisting the arsenal. A medical monitoring advisory group was created to establish a medical monitoring program for communities surrounding the arsenal. The Rocky Mountain Arsenal Wildlife Society was formed as a nonprofit organization dedicated to helping the refuge through financial support and direct volunteering. The Restoration Advisory Board serves as a forum for local communities, the RVO, and regulatory agencies to work together in an atmosphere that encourages discussion and the exchange of information about the remediation. A milestone was reached when the first of 31 remediation projects outlined in the ROD was completed in early 1998, the Sanitary and Chemical Sewer Plugging Project. More than 250 manholes and 130 sewer lines were removed or plugged to prevent access and block potential pathways for contamination of groundwater. Of all of the projects underway, it is the OnPost Hazardous Waste Landfill that is the cornerstone of the cleanup program. The landfill will accept waste from 18 different cleanup projects. The completed landfill will feature double and triple lined cells and will be capped with a multi-layered, fully protective vegetated soil cover. The landfill accepts only material from the arsenal and is equipped with a leak detection and collection system and a groundwater monitoring system. Almost all of the structures at the arsenal will be demolished. They include buildings, foundations, basements, tanks, pipelines, and other man-made items. Those structures with significant levels of contamination will also be placed in the landfill. The landfill will also contain the most contaminated soil from the arsenal. Areas where concentrations of soil contamination may not present much of a threat to animals will be placed in Basin A as fill. Structures that pose no contamination threat will also be placed in Basin A, which will be covered with a rock layer to prevent contact with wildlife and protect the public. Researchers are testing to see if a natural soil and vegetation cover will produce the same results as a traditional plastic man-made cover. The natural soil cover is considered more environmentally friendly and cost-effective. Another aspect of the soil remediation deals with shell and army disposal trenches. These trenches have underground walls built around them and have a cover design that meets or exceeds federal and state regulations. The total cost of the cleanup, including money spent to date by the Army and Shell, is approximately $2 billion. Cleanup is projected to be completed between the year 2007 and 2011, depending on the manner in which Congress allocates funds to the Army. Both during and after the active cleanup program, on-site visitor and worker safety is a top priority. Access is carefully regulated. Much of the arsenal is already safe for visitors, and more areas will become accessible as the cleanup is completed. During the cleanup, appropriate revegetation and mitigation of some of the habitat will occur, including close to 10,000 acres of native short grass prairie. A number of habitat research and enhancement programs are well underway, including seeding programs, weed control, and propagation and irrigation projects to enhance the native prairie. The Fish and Wildlife Service also is closely managing and protecting various species at the arsenal, such as the bald eagle, America's national symbol. In 1986, a communal roost of bald eagles was discovered on site. The arsenal is an important winter destination point for this once endangered species. As many as 80 eagles roost nightly during winter months in cottonwood groves along First Creek and at the arsenal's lakes, attracted by the nearby prairie dog population and relative lack of human disturbance. Prairie dogs are the main food source for wintering bald eagles at the arsenal. Prairie dog burrows also serve as shelter for burrowing owls, rabbits, and rattlesnakes. From hawks and deer to coyotes and great horned owls, it is the great diversity of wildlife that attracts so many visitors. And there is no age limit when it comes to learning about wildlife and nature. The Fish and Wildlife Service works in cooperation with groups in the community and has organized an active corps of volunteers to assist wildlife researchers and conduct programs for the public. The public will continue to be an important part of the arsenal's outreach program, which includes meetings for discussion on cleanup, environmental education, tours of the arsenal, and continued participation in the many programs underway. The Rocky Mountain Arsenal is moving ahead into the next phase of its history as it is transformed into a wildlife refuge. This new refuge will be one of the largest urban refuges and among more than 500 national wildlife refuges across the country. A safe, successful cleanup will allow the arsenal to return to its roots as a sanctuary for its wildlife inhabitants. The Rocky Mountain Arsenal National Wildlife Refuge will continue to provide more educational and recreational opportunities for its many neighbors who truly appreciate the joys of nature and become a true asset to the people of Colorado.
Well, that video gives you a little bit of a more dynamic view of this particular site, as well as some of the archival footage of the historical contamination, how things happen. In a certain sense, because I still do have a brother-in-law working on site, I can report that this is still an active cleanup site. It's actively being managed, actively being cleaned up, and will probably be active for about another 10 years or so. Our next case is the Chemdine Hamilton, Ohio site. This also has some personal interest for me because I went to high school in Hamilton, Ohio. Hamilton, Ohio is just north of Cincinnati, Ohio. I'll show you that in a map here in a moment. This site is from a 10-acre waste management site, went by the name of Chemdine. It was operated as an industrial chemical waste transfer, disposal, and storage facility on the edge of town. They're actually quite close to the downtown area. Hamilton has a population of approximately 90,000 people, so this is not a small town, small community. It's a blue-collar industrial community. There's a paper mill in town, Mosier Safe Company in town. Many of the banks across the United States have safes from the Mosier Safe Company, and it used to be involved in auto parts manufacturing back in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. The problem with the Chemdine site in terms of where it is in the community, it's located about 1,000 feet from a residential area. So here you've got an industrial chemical waste management facility essentially right up next to residential areas and, in fact, a recreational park and play fields. This is quite dramatic, I don't know, perhaps poor planning in terms of the city fathers that allowed this sort of industrial activity to occur in what amounts to a residential area. This is part of, for example, what some people refer to as environmental justice concerns, the fact that quite often we find these fairly contaminated processes happening in areas like it was in Hamilton of lower income, poverty level individuals. It's an unfortunate situation that is a part of our environmental history. In the Chemdine plant, this is a chemical waste processing plant. On site, there were about 250 chemical waste generators that had contracted with Chemdine to essentially take care of their problem, to take care of their chemical waste at these industries. And these are sometimes very named industries like PPG, Pittsburgh Paint and Glass. You may have used PPG products yourself in a certain sense. Before there was a RCRA law, before there was even some Superfund law, there was a little bit of the wild, wild west in the 50s, 60s, and 70s in terms of managing hazardous waste, even actively produced, actively produced hazardous waste. The Chemdine facility had an operational lifetime of 1974 to 1980, so it was only 6 years of operation, but it was 6 years long enough to create quite a mess. There were 50,000 drums of waste stored on site at the height of operations. These are 55-gallon drums, industrial-sized drums. If you can imagine the problems of putting that in a residential neighborhood. Chemdine demonstrated tremendously poor waste handling practices. Sometimes there was purposeful on-site spillage of various chemicals. This had to do with perhaps the lack of oversight, regulatory infrastructure, and midnight operations, if you will, of digging a ditch and emptying a barrel into it. In a certain sense, in this particular regulatory environment, in this community environment perhaps, There was an economic incentive to cheat. A drum that you poured into a ditch that you laid out on a country road was a drum that you didn't have to worry about, that essentially someone gave you some money to manage this, to do some incineration or waste management on it. They handed off their waste to you. It wasn't their problem anymore. In a certain sense, if you cut some corners on managing that waste, your profit margins could be higher. There were direct discharge of liquid waste into storm drains or sewers, and on site there was mixing of incompatible wastes. These are some of the activities that are cited in the regulatory reports. I can also tell you that because I know people who know people in this particular situation, that the Chemdyne folks were doing some tremendously violative activities. Things like taking tanker trucks out onto country roads, opening up the drain valves, and then taking a midnight drive until all of the waste had emptied out of the tanker trucks. The people managing this were in fact environmental criminals of the highest degree. They did get pursued in that, and you can actually Google around on the internet and find out some of the legal aspects of the prosecution of the owners of this particular company. Chemdyne, as I said, is located in Hamilton, Ohio, so we're down here in the southeastern corner of Ohio, just north of Cincinnati, not far from the Indiana and Kentucky border. They call us the tri-state area. What this is a relatively blue-collar. We're getting kind of into that whole rust belt area of manufacturing in the United States. And in a certain sense, a facility here could deal with the manufacturing operations in the eastern as well as the Midwest part of the United States. This is an overview map of Hamilton, Ohio, and I've done this just to address some of the problems in terms of groundwater flow. Chemdyne is the site here in red. I've put a red outline on this. This is the downtown part of the most urban area of Hamilton. You start getting into more residential areas down here. What's of interest, and I'll tell you why, was the paper mill. Champion Papers associated here. I, in fact, worked a couple summer jobs at the paper mill. My high school was over in this direction on this map. This is the Great Miami River, and it's flowing in this direction. You can see it in the blue. What I want you to identify is that there, in fact, is a canal here, a small canal that runs right next to the Chemdyne site. They call it the Ford Canal. I'll give you a little bit of location. There is a manufacturing facility here, a metal manufacturing facility, so there are people working right next to the site here. There's also the community power plant, which is a coal-fired power plant right here. There's a couple of little retention dams here. And then also you need to know about groundwater dynamics here. Groundwater flow is in general in this particular direction, and so you're going to have some sort of influence between the flow of the Greater Miami River and the groundwater here. But I also want to alert you to the operations in a paper mill. Paper and pulp mills are always located near water bodies because these industrial operations use a tremendous amount of water. In this particular case, the pumps from these plants used wells that actually did have some dramatic impact on groundwater levels that are important in the groundwater dynamics, as you'll see in this particular case. And this is a little bit of closer up map. This is our red area, the Chemdyne site here. Here's the Ford Canal coming in next to it. In fact, here's the Great Miami River coming down here. So you've got the power plants and materials, power plant operations over here. There's Champion Paper facilities. What's interesting, you can see that this is referred to as the North End Athletic Field. In fact, this is ball fields historically next to this industrial site. This is all residential area right here. So essentially right across the street from this site was a residential area. Well, so in terms of the history of this particular site, chemical wastes were trucked on this site beginning in 1974. Waste that were unsuitable for recycling or recovery via like distillation or separation were actually stored in drums and tanks on the site or shipped to other disposal sites. Some of these activities, again, were driving into the forest and opening up and dumping. There's been some tremendous problematic, again, case histories of illegal dumping going on with this particular operation. There are more than 30,000 drums of waste and about 300,000 gallons of bulk waste materials that were left on site when the operations ended in 1980. Again, 30,000 drums, 55-gallon drums, some of these in very poor condition. During its operation, a number of environmental incidents were reported. In 1976-1979, there were at least 5 fish kills in the Great Miami River that were attributable to the Chemdyne facility. So there was a release. How that release was happening, whether it was storm drain release or release that was coming through groundwater infiltration into the Great Miami River. One of the fish kills stretched for 37 miles. Now recall that we did not have a huge body of environmental law in the early 1970s, things like NEPA, natural resources damages. Some of these things were less actionable than they would be today in terms of legal potential for recovery. There were fires that occurred in the site in 1976 and 1979. I graduated from high school in 1973. My friends, even though I was on the other part of the state during these fires, my friends that witnessed this said the sky was lit up with some of these fires. One of them particularly dramatic was shooting some of these 55-gallon drums up into the air like missiles. Some of these missiles actually exceeded the tops of the smokestacks from the nearby power plants. So they went up several hundred feet in the air. Again, think of yourself as being a resident, a nearby resident in this particular site. I did have some anecdotal information, some conversations that, and there was an investigation about this fire, that there may have been arson involved, and the arson may have been linked to individuals that were actually working in the metalworking plant next door. You have to remember that here's people that are showing up for a 9-to-5 job every day next to doing their job and managing their environment in a relative responsible way, but the fumes that were coming from the industrial facility next door were actually making many of the workers sick. And so there's some anecdotal evidence and some comments among friends that maybe somebody went over there and put an end to it because they were sick and tired of being sick from the fumes they had to breathe every day from this next door facility. Next door to this, as you recall, that was from the maps, was the Ford Canal, and the Ford Canal flowed into the Great Miami River. So anything that came off of the site that got into the canal. Now this was an industrial canal that drained many industrial areas that went by some of the automobile parts manufacturing plants, and so there was a level of contamination. It was only used for drainage. There was a little bit of a hydraulic dam operation there. The Great Miami River, however, is used for recreation and recreational fishing. The water supplies in the area rely on groundwater for their source. So if you contaminate local groundwater, you contaminate the drinking water resource for a substantial part of the community. This is what it looked like on my last visit to the area, which was in 2000. This is looking across the field of Chemdyne. The Ford Canal is behind here along this tree line. You can see that right now it's just an open field. You'll see wellheads here. These are wellheads that are connected to a pump and treat operation. I'll show you in a second. The pump and treat uses volatile removals to remove some of the solvents out of the groundwater. It's now operated by the Chemdyne Trust. The Chemdyne Trust is a financial recovery trust of all of the PRPs, the potentially responsible parties. All of the manufacturing operations that contributed waste to the Chemdyne site were actually legally liable in historical terms from Superfund legislation, and so in fact they had to pay up for the ongoing cleanup of this particular site. The idea is to pump and treat to remove this, and we'll see how they came to that whole pump and treat, and we'll talk about some of the current challenges they have in this site. This is what it looks like. You can see the well heads in terms of monitoring wells, but there are wells on site that are pump wells where they pump the groundwater. They take it up in this volatiles removal, and what they do is they run a fast current of air back beyond trickling water. It allows the volatiles to be released. The volatiles are then taken in a gas stream to either a liquid recovery unit or a little miniature incinerator. And the idea is to strip or to vapor strip out these on the basis of their Henry's Law constant. This is in operation. It's manned every day. It's pumping and treating, and so you can imagine having been in place for a considerable amount of time, the amount of water that's been treated exceeds a billion gallons. This is what the facility looks like if I stand on the bank of the Ford Canal, and so again, here's the air stripping unit. And this is where the personnel operating the site, but this is the contaminated field, and this is where the monitoring wells are. And this is the metal manufacturing facility that was unrelated to the site, just happened to be next door. And across the street, you can see some of the residential areas associated with this site. Where the Ford Canal comes into the Greater Miami River, here you can see the power plant. I talked about the drums during the fire were being blasted in the air at a height greater than the power plant. There was a newspaper article that showed a very dramatic picture of a drum being exploded up into the air. But you can see that, in fact, the Ford Canal entry right here, and in fact, the day I was there, which was again in 2000, there were people that were fishing. This is a recreational fishery. This is up on the Ford Canal. This gives you an idea of the size and the dynamic. This is a sampling boom out here. These are actually my two kids and my young niece on the border here. The idea, again, this does look like it would be contaminated. This is something that you would find kids playing with and perhaps even people recreating in this canal. As it turns out, the canal sediments are contaminated with a variety of constituents of concern. Downstream from the site, we found polyaromatic hydrocarbons at about 1 to 2 parts per million, various solvents like toluene at 1 part per million, methylphenol, chlordane, chromium and lead are up approaching the hundreds of parts per million in the sediment downstream from this site. So there was active demonstration of contamination from the Chemdyne facility. It's interesting also, and I've stepped in this picture across the street. You can see the site in the background, again, just across the street, and we're talking about throwing a rock and being able to hit the Chemdyne site. And so here's kids' toys out in the yard. Here's the site. This is about 15 years after it was the cleanup started, but historically these residential areas have been there for quite some time. Now, in terms of the contamination, the approach to cleanup of contamination, we in the environmental engineering, environmental management, risk assessment arena actually use Chemdyne as a classroom. It was one of the largest, most complex sites to be remediated under some of the new hazardous waste management laws that came to play in the 80s. And so in a certain sense, folks have documented Chemdyne in terms of learning from our mistakes, because several mistakes were made in approaching the cleanup, the mitigation, the risk management of Chemdyne. It's a complex site because the groundwater is primarily contaminated with some of these VOCs and heavy metals. There was no evidence that drinking water supplies were affected in terms of some of the deeper wells. The soil on the site was contaminated with VOCs and pesticides and some organic compounds and heavy metals. The heavy metals included mercury, arsenic, nickel, and beryllium. Some of the on-site buildings were contaminated with PCBs, so the range of contamination is quite significant. If you took a look at drilling some monitoring wells and pulling samples, some of these samples kind of allowed the dynamics of the plume, the subsurface dynamics of the plume, to be identified. What we have in 1983 in terms of the groundwater VOCs, and the red zones are 1,000 micrograms per liter, or about one part per million. And so we have high density point sources in these zones here. But as the plume kind of starts moving out, we get down to a level of about one-tenth of that out here at the yellow. But you can kind of see that the dynamics, even though the diversity of the point sources are such that they're all across this site, you can see that the groundwater dynamics are starting to pull it in this direction, just similar to the map that we showed earlier on in this presentation. In 1980, when EPA came in and its contractors, they stabilized, removed, and disposed about 17 potentially explosive drums, and they shipped those off to a treatment facility. We manage hazardous waste now with a variety of chemical and physical characteristics like explosiveness, ignition, and a few others. In 1982, EPA removed about another 9,000 drums. These are drums that could be removed and solidified. And they also pumped about 200,000 gallons of liquid and solid waste that were available on site in about 33 different storage tanks. And so this is quite a mobilization, just even looking at the pure waste material, not necessarily the contaminated environmental materials. In 1985, EPA issued a ROD, or a Record of Decision, and we'll talk about in our environmental law, Superfund, and Records of Decision. Records of Decision, in short, are just the final decision of the regulatory authorities on what will be done according to the prescribed cleanup of the site. What techniques, what approaches, what timetable is a part of the Record of Decision. There's cost analyses, there's technology analyses, feasibility and risk analyses that go into this decision-making process. It requires the installation of a system to extract the groundwater and treat it by airstripping, and you saw that facility. The contaminants are then further treated with activated carbon before being released into the air. Some of the buildings on site were demolished and selected areas of soil were removed. These are ones that had a tremendous amount of stabilized contamination within the soil. And there was a synthetic cap and a clay layer placed over the site. And the reason we do this on these contaminated sites is to prevent infiltration of any more precipitation or surface water that would drive this plume even deeper and farther off of site. Again, our goal in hazardous waste management is TMV, elimination of toxicity, mobility, or volume. A cap will limit mobility. Well, as you saw in the initial site survey map that we showed, that the groundwater flowed west towards the Greater Miami River. There was a shallow trough that flowed parallel to the river, as you would imagine, because the river would scrub out the alluvial material. There would be more porosity there. There would be a change in water dynamics because of the water that flows in the river. And there was some stream influences from this particular water body. There was an initial survey that's concluded that the contaminants already in the aquifer would be discharged into the Greater Miami River, and it would not need to be removed. Essentially, it concluded that removal of the top 3 feet of soil would eliminate the source of the contaminants. The groundwater that's already impacted would drain slowly to the Greater Miami River, and it would be treated as a dilution, being the solution to pollution over a period of time. What's nice about this is, maybe we are down below critical threshold levels in terms of toxicity. We'll let nature take care of this. It's a low-cost option. Well, as it turns out, this really wasn't an accurate assessment of the subsurface hydrology. There were some faulty soil sampling procedures, especially with VOCs. Remember, these are volatile organic compounds. When you sample these, you have to drill a core in what's referred to as a split spoon sampler. These samples then need to be in tightly containerized vessels to trap the VOCs. Many of these recommended sampling procedures or VOCs were not followed, and so the initial sampling gave some erroneous results. The oily upper surface soils showed high VOCs because of co-solvation of the VOCs by some of the viscous oils and other chemicals. And so we talked about co-salvation in our transport lectures. What happened was there were some VOCs that were being assisted in their transportation or their sequestration by some of the other contaminants. They did not migrate far enough to exert some of this co-salvation beyond the first few feet of the soil profile. There were some additional site investigations. Some of these incorporated a more detailed characterization of the sediments and the natural flow system, some of the vertical profiles that were developed, again, by coring samples to get a better idea of what's going on beneath your feet here. Don't assume the subsurface, especially around water bodies, can be quite complex. What they finally figured in terms of looking at all of the complex subsurface hydrodynamics, where the surface flows were, looking at pump tests, that there were some nearby large industrial wells, especially the one associated with the paper mill, that were actually causing the subsurface gradient to drop dramatically compared to the normal horizon. We saw that in the groundwater demonstrator on lecture, I believe it's 15 or 18. I posted a groundwater simulator. If you watch that, you can see that pumping will change the dynamics. It'll drive things deeper, drive things shallower, depending upon where you're pumping from. And so this pumping, the millions of gallons a day being pumped by a paper mill, will in fact dramatically change the hydrodynamics in the subsurface. The modeling that was done after this understanding was achieved demonstrated that the plume coming off of the Chemdyne site would actually drop below the area of influence of the Great Miami River. What this implies is that it has the potential to contaminate the deeper drinking water resources. This was a significant observation. To confirm the modeling, there was a major pump test. This is extraordinarily expensive. What they do is they pull water from some of these test and monitoring wells, and then they watch levels at other wells in terms of are the levels going up or down, what's the rate that they go up and down, to establish dynamics of hydroconductivity, what's connected, what's the rate of change as you pump water from one place to another in the subsurface. All of this information is extraordinarily valuable. However, it was very costly because there was about 100,000 gallons of contaminated water and various individuals associated with the site and operations because of the complexity and the hazard of this contaminated water. They had to be operated with people in personal air tanks, full personal protection gear. The monitoring wells and monitoring flow, this helped, again, explain some of the unusual plume dynamics that were observed in monitoring samples, and it also helped in the design for the pump and treat system that they finally put into play here. As well, Chemdyne was studied for contaminant biotransformations. In a certain sense, our organic chemicals are now have the potential to be acted on by local microbial ecology. We did see some biodegradation occurring. Some of this had to do with the tetrachloroethylene were dehalogenated to various daughter products, including trichloroethylene, dichloroethylene, and vinyl chloride. You can see that happening in this particular series on this slide. And so what started out as being a primary contaminant, we now have several contaminants, and it was very interesting in terms of the follow-up analysis to look at the more aged material at the outskirts of the plume actually had a higher degree of biodegradation occurring. The groundwater pump and treat system has been in operation since 1988, and it may continue through as much as 2008 or longer. My most recent information suggests it is going to be longer because as it has pumped, this dynamic has actually started to slow down in terms of the reversal of some of the, there seems to be residual capacity like we talked about in our transport and abiotic processes discussions. So there's some sorption processes, they're not being able to flush it out at the same rate and meet the early success they did in the early years. Approximately 3.5 billion gallons of groundwater have been treated, and about 31,000 pounds of volatile organic parent compound have been removed from the aquifer. And so this is 31,000 pounds of material that was illegally discharged or wasted to the ground. terms of the plume reduction, the idea here, you can kind of see that over the years from 1986 to 1992, as they started pumping, there was a reduction, a pullback of the plume to lower concentrations. These are the monitoring wells. The purple was the 1992. There were 8 shallow extraction wells, 7 deeper extraction wells, some injection wells that processed about 1 million gallons per day. So this is a significant turnover, a tremendous expense in terms of pump and treat. Again, there was a protective cap put over the top of this so there wouldn't be infiltration of precipitation. And the plume was reduced from over 10 parts per million to just about 0.3 parts per million. So it's all going in the right direction in terms of mitigating the mobilization of this contaminant in the surface. This gives you a graph of the cumulative mass of VOCs being removed over the time period in most recent history up here to the late 90s. You can see that the dynamics in terms of the pump and treat, they were significant in the earliest stages, the earliest years. It seemed to approach a steady state in terms of recovery, but this is the current plateauing effect that at least in the early 2000s they were looking for a way, is there a way we can accelerate this? Fortunately, this is a shallow aquifer contamination incident. There is no drinking water that is being used from this particular aquifer. So in terms of the relative risk of the remaining contamination, it's minimal because receptor involvement is minimal. What we try to learn from EPA's management of the Chemdyne site in the 70s and 80s is the role of modeling and calculations associated with this. Many of the contaminants did follow the relative rates of transport that we predicted by sorption principles, so this is good. Anytime you can take a pencil to a piece of paper and work up a model and make some predictions, this is extraordinarily useful in terms of site management. You can imagine that a pump and treat facility operating at 1 million gallons a day is probably costing the PRPs tens of millions, if not hundreds of millions of dollars in terms of its lifespan of history and the amount of money being drilled in to support the Chemdyne Trust for operation. It was used in the estimating the capacity of the treatment system and the length of the time needed. The prediction that pump and treat would be effective at the interior of the plume but not at the periphery was actually confirmed. This is a modeling result. Air stripping is used extensively, and it's actually been a reasonable engineering approach in terms of managing the contamination in this water. This particular site demonstrated the importance of knowing the natural process parameters. In a certain sense, the earliest stage of the investigation, when people said, okay, this is a shallow aquifer contamination, it's going to drain, we're going to have dilution in the Great Miami River, and we're not going to have to actively manage the site other than sealing off the contaminated soil, was a wrong stance. And in fact, as they really understood the subsurface dynamics, they got to understand a better, stronger approach to managing and mitigating the hazard associated with this contaminated site. This is a pretty dramatic evaluation, follow-up, and learning experience. This also is searchable in terms of some of the reports, some of the follow-up, in terms of the regulatory science documents, the community documents, because it still is being actively managed. Our final case study for today and for this series of 4 case studies lectures is an interesting one. I thought I'd give you something that was a little bit lighter, perhaps a little bit more fun, if you will, because of its Pacific Island environment. This is Midway Island. This is an aerial view of Midway Island over here, and you can see that in World War II, this was dominated as by an airstrip, a military airstrip. It was used as a refueling station because of its strategic location in the Pacific Theater. It's part of the Midway Atoll, and so you can see here's Midway Island, you can see the atoll, and you can see there's actually 2 smaller islands to the side. But you can see that human activity has dominated this very small island in terms of runways and support facilities on this particular small island. It was, again, a naval air refueling station during World War II. It's only 1,535 acres, so it's quite small. But it's also because of its strategic location for our Air Force and for pilots. It's also a strategic layover spot for the Pacific Ocean bird nesting migrations and their nesting areas. There were over 2 million birds actively using this when they counted in the 90s as a nesting site. You can see that during nesting season, this is an old military gun post. You can see that, in fact, it's been overtaken by the goony birds and various other species. On site, many of these oil tanks, as you would imagine, for the jet fuel and the diesel fuel associated with a refueling station. What's interesting in terms of the dynamics, we're looking at about 3,000 miles from San Francisco, about 2,000 miles from Japan. Hawaii, it's about 1,100 miles here, so you can see that it's somewhat out in the middle of nowhere here, and so its strategic value as a refueling station in the Pacific theater was pretty significant. In the 1990s, the U.S. went through a base realignment and closure program, or BRAC, for many military installations. Many of these were holdovers from World War I, World War II, and the Cold War years. Many of these facilities were aged and ancient facilities. Midway Island was one of these. And Congress, with the authority from the President, ordered that these bases be closed and decommissioned. The operational closure of Midway Island actually happened in 1993. In this particular case, we also have a transfer to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. This transfer actually happened in 1996. And again, by an act of Congress, it was transitioned to the Midway Island National Wildlife Refuge. And you can see as they did this handover, lowering the flag, you can see the various seabirds in the audience. The goony birds, the various bird populations on this island are significant and very colorful in terms of their mating dances, such as the goony bird dance here. It's a significant ecological resource for the Pacific Island nations in terms of bird populations. The range of contamination on this, again, primarily from World War II activities when the U.S. government was far more concerned about military operations than environmental contamination. Jet fuel leaked from underground storage tanks into the atoll's groundwater. There are various old buildings on site. Some of these had asbestos and lead paint. Utility transformers and the PCBs that were associated with the dielectrics of these transformers, and various other chemicals, malaria, anti-malaria insecticides like DDT that were used on site. All of these had the potential and actual result of leaching into the soil. There were various inorganics and heavy metal contaminants, mercury and lead from old batteries on this particular site. In terms of remediation recovery, the jet fuel and the diesel and the fuel oil that powered some of the electrical generators on site needed to be removed from the atoll's groundwater. That lied about 5 to 8 feet below this sandy surface on this Pacific island. Now remember that these jet fuel, diesel, and bunker fuel oils were actually light non-aqueous phase liquids, light meaning that they float like an oil slick on water. So again, what happens to review that if we put concentrated oil plume on a sandy soil, gravity will drop it down, especially if it's a dry sandy soil. Over time, the sand will become saturated, but if that has a sufficient amount of source material, it will drop until it hits the groundwater layer, again in 5 to 8 feet here, and then start spreading like a oil slick in the subsurface profile. And what's good about that is at least there is a barrier. What's bad about that is there is a potential for contamination of the water, low level, even though these are immiscible contaminants. The potential for trace amounts of organic materials to enter the water is real. The island residents used catchment systems for drinking because of the contaminated aquifer, and so they caught rainwater and stored it in various vessels and tanks on site. This brackish groundwater was being cleaned to protect wildlife in the ocean. The total cost of cleanup was $43 million. It happened that my brother-in-law was actually the cleanup manager for this site, so I had kind of an interesting personal point of view of some of the dynamics and the challenges, especially the challenges of mobilization of all of the cleanup equipment and personnel to an extraordinarily remote location. The remediation approach in this particular site was a steam injection vapor extraction system. The idea, by heating up the steam, it would make many of the fuel oils flow a little bit easier, extract off of the sands. It was the world's largest such system ever used at Midway. The petroleum hydrocarbon contaminated water was extracted from about 300 wells that were drilled around the island and run through various tanks. The vapor was burned off and the fuel oil was actually collected. It was quite interesting that the fuel oil that they collected were actually used in the generators they were using to power the pumps and the operations on site. So in a certain sense, they closed the system, recovered much of the fuel oil. They actually used it in the vehicles and the mechanical operations on site to essentially power the cleanup operations. Purified groundwater from this was actually returned to the ground through about a series of 200 injection wells on site. So this 33,000 gallons of petroleum hydrocarbons that actually recovered were used to power two 16-cylinder generators that worked around the clock. There was no leftover fuel at the end of all of this that needed to be shipped off. So that was a strong positive in terms of this. The crews removed about 100 underground jet fuel tanks. They included two with a capacity of 2 million gallons each, and so this was a fairly large-scale construction destruction job. There were 7,000 cubic yards of soil contaminated with petroleum hydrocarbons that had to be excavated. The contaminated soil was either stabilized with cement or used as road fill on the surface. Just to make some sort of use and to get it out of the potential aquifer. There were marine salvage operations because, again, during military operations, if a truck didn't work, it was pushed out into the atoll, into the water, get it out of the way. There were 68 vehicles and 300 batteries that were actually dumped into the lagoon. Navy divers went in and detonated 23 gas cylinders that were in the harbor. Various water, sediment, and biota were sampled. There were some initial concerns about extensive marine pollution that was not borne out in terms of the sampling results. The Navy retiring the facilities were actually kept on site. They didn't destroy all the facilities. The idea was to keep this island active not only as a breeding ground but also as an ecotourism facility. You had to have a little bit of facility, including a landing strip, to actually encourage this ecotourism and the recovery to the island and the people that actually still live on the island. This is an interesting quote. This is by one of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service managers that actually worked on the Midway Island Refuge. It's telling in terms of giving us a sensitivity of what we can do with some of these historical contaminations. The quote goes like this: Midway will never be taken back to what it was before man got here, but this is an example of humans cleaning up and giving back to wildlife. And with the world's population expanding, there are not many places like that. And so this is an encouraging recovery operation, encouraging in that we know we can do it, perhaps discouraging that the problem happened to start with. Environmental sensitivities of the modern military are greatly improved. What used to be, for example, ships that discharged their waste in ports are now have onboard waste management treatment systems for a variety of wastes. So we have come full circle, including even our military operations and our management of potential chemicals that can impact the environment. Well, this gives you the closure of these four lectures on environmental case studies. We've tried to address a range of concerns, a range of, I think, interesting cases. Unfortunately, again, to apologize to you that we could not necessarily get to the depth of each one of these. As you can see, Midway Island, a half dozen slides, was actually $43 million worth of operations. All of the technical reports associated with many of these sites and the governmental authorities associated with these sites are usually available on the internet or in various library formats or case study reviews done by various professional environmental historical reviewers. Those should give you, again, some sensitivity of some of the dynamics that apply to the basic principles that you are learning in this course. Next time, what we'll do following a midterm exam is we'll start a brief analysis of the concern about endocrine disruption before we start finishing up the semester's material with some of the active management resources that we have in terms of public process, things like environmental laws, things like setting up quality assurance project plans to actually go into these contaminated sites and do the best jobs that we can with available resources. Until that time, we'll see you. Thanks.